It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, when COVID-19 changed our daily lives, the advertising world was quick to change its tone. We'll talk about the rise of the pandemic ad. First, bars and restaurants around Wisconsin and the country are opening back up after more than a month of being closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Some are welcoming customers like normal. Others are acting under local restrictions to operate at reduced capacity. While being shut down was a big financial blow for restaurants, reopening can come with its own expenses, and a lot of restaurant owners say it's a struggle to cover the cost without knowing what's ahead. Heather Haddon is a reporter covering restaurants for the Wall Street Journal. She's based in Chicago. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Before we get to those reopening expenses, I know restaurants can be a tough business even in good times. How hard hit have they been over the last couple months?
Yeah, it's really been incredible, especially for independent restaurants, which is what so many diners love to go to, their local Main Street restaurants. So the sit-down dining bans that folded out in March meant that most of them lost nearly all of their sales. So unless a business already had a robust to-go operation, was doing delivery and takeout, it basically had to shut down. The ones that did have to-go options, you know, maybe they replaced 10, 20% of their sales, at least initially, with those takeout operations. But otherwise, their business basically shut down, which has really meant, you know, closing down kitchens, furloughing workers, having to negotiate with their landlords on rent deferrals, if possible, if they could obtain that. And their suppliers. And so a lot of those restaurants have been effectively dormant until now, when suddenly, you know, they have the option to turn the lights back on. But resuming business just really isn't that easy either.
That's a key part of a piece you wrote recently. If I'm a restaurant owner, even if tomorrow I can open up to full capacity, in some ways it's easier said than done, in part because that's kind of the cash flow and supply flow issue. Can you talk about what a lot of the restaurant owners you talk to are facing?
Yeah, I think the pandemic has really exposed something that's been true in the restaurant industry for a long time now, for many, many years, that they run on very thin margins. So the business and the revenue they bring in today, they really need to keep going, to buy the supplies, the fish, the produce, to pay their electricity bills, to pay their workers, to pay their rent. They need customers in their seats to be able to buy all those things to, you know, to operate. So, you know, a lot of restaurants work on credit lines that, you know, they buy goods and guarantee their suppliers future revenue and future profits to keep going. So because of that, a lot of them had bills when they closed down. They hadn't paid all their suppliers and, you know, hopefully worked out some terms to arrange for those situations. But now they're facing debt when they open, and no guarantee that they will have the same business or anywhere near the same business when they open again. So it's put in a lot of restaurant owners into a real debate. How do they reopen again? What kind of service level should they be opening again at? How much food should they buy if they have the money to buy food? And should they take on new debt and credit to do that? And that's really a debate I think a lot of restaurants are having right now. How to reopen? Can they reopen? And what kind of restaurant should they be if they can reopen?
If I am that restaurant owner, even if I want to take on new debt, are the people who usually loan to a small business like a restaurant ready to give me that loan, given that I might already be behind on my bills and, as you say, not sure how many people are going to come through the door tomorrow?
Yeah, I think it really depends on what kind of lender relationship you had before and the size of the lender before. And I've really heard all kinds of different situations, with some lenders being very forgiving, willing to extend, you know, some wiggle room on credit to their restaurant clients, whereas others not so much. And, you know, particularly for some of these smaller guys, again, you know, this is all they have to exist on. But for their bank, you know, they have to think about, and again, you know, some of these smaller banks are also servicing other customers, commercial customers that are not doing well as well. So, you know, small retailers, other kind of consumer oriented businesses that really have been decimated by this. So they might not be willing to extend a lot of wiggle room here, and maybe the terms are not so great. So, you know, some of these loans have very high interest rates. It's just not in the restaurant's interest to get into more debt again on uncertain terms.
Heather Haddon is with us from the Wall Street Journal. We are looking at restaurants, how they were hit by COVID-19 and the struggles as they try to reopen in part or entirely. If you own or work at a restaurant, we'd love to hear from you how you are dealing with these issues at 800-642-1234. If you were a restaurant customer in the past, are you one now? Are you happy and willing to go in and sit down in a restaurant? Call in at 800-642-1234. Another wrinkle here, Heather, and another expense you write about is safety, trying to make sure everything is sanitized, and how are restaurants trying to cope with the reality of that and the costs of that?
Yeah, and this is affecting every kind of restaurant. So from the biggest chain, you know, McDonald's owners to, again, those independent restaurants, that buying all those masks and gloves is very, very expensive. One restaurant owner I talked to, big chain owner in Michigan, said they were going through something like $100 worth of masks and gloves per restaurant per week. I mean, that's just, you know, one of his locations having to spend just that much on masks and gloves. This particular restaurant, it was an Applebee's owner, also had to hire specialists just to sanitize. That's a cost they expect to keep incurring for the long term right now. So this is someone who is just wiping down booths, wiping down benches, you know, making sure everything is clean to reassure customers, to make sure they feel okay to visit the restaurant, and to keep people safe. So keeping their workers safe, keeping their diners safe. So that's a whole new expense they didn't have before, again, which they're having to pay for with less revenue.
You also wrote about the reality facing, you know, the people who are the face of restaurants, the servers, the people who are actually at your table when you go in and eat. They're trying to serve with a smile through a mask, trying to reassure people that, yeah, we're handling things as safely as we can. How has their reality changed?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, a lot of servers have worked in the restaurant business for a very long time, particularly at sit-down restaurants. They like the interaction. That's part of what they crave, and that's why they do this, you know, very hard job being on your feet all day. Now they're having to do it with a mask. There's also a lot of guidelines that restaurant owners have imposed about how many times they can so-called touch the table or the customer. You know, they have to very much limit their contact with the number of other diners and customers in the restaurant. There's also rules now for how customers can enter the restaurant. So hostesses have to, you know, sort of play safety guard here. They have to tell people when it's safe to enter the restaurant, you know, that maybe they need to wait in their car before they even get into the restaurant. So really the nature of being a server or a hostess or a busboy in a restaurant has really changed. It's become much more compartmentalized and rigid in a lot of ways. And, you know, I just think wearing a mask all day at work, I think that would be really hard to be able to breathe, let alone interact for these servers. Now, on the kind of fast food employee, their work has also changed. You know, they're also wearing a mask all day. It's very regimented about where they can be in the kitchen or in the dining room of the fast food restaurant. So, again, a lot of new rules for these workers to consider.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Alamo is with us in Madison. Alamo, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
I was curious to know what you guys thought of the fact that most restaurants, being a former cook, they do not usually own their own space, meaning that they're paying high rents on top of everything, usually because of central locations. I'm just curious to know what you guys thought about that.
Thanks for calling in, Heather. Restaurants and rents.
Yeah, no, that has been a real flashpoint. And again, that's true for even the biggest chains. You know, we've written about big chains like Starbucks Cheesecake Factory, all trying to renegotiate their rents because, again, they had such diminished, depleted revenue coming in during the coronavirus pandemic. And yeah, they don't own their properties. So really have been trying to scramble to get breaks on the rents. But again, for these landlords, often they have other properties coming to them at the same time. So retailers that also were closed, you know, other kinds of businesses that are really looking for handouts. So I think it's been a real mixed bag. Some landlords have, you know, granted, often I would say, waivers, not full on abatements, to try to give some relief to keep these restaurants going. But, you know, they have to pay their bills, and some of them are publicly traded. So they have shareholders to think about as well.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Heather Haddon, restaurant reporter for The Wall Street Journal, looking at the cost of reopening after being closed because of the coronavirus pandemic facing restaurants big and small around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your life? Are you a restaurant owner who's reopening or trying to reopen? What has this all meant for you? If you're a restaurant worker, love to hear from you. And on the customer side of thing, are you ready to start going to restaurants again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Heather Haddon, restaurant reporter for The Wall Street Journal, talking about why reopening after COVID-19 and during COVID-19 can be an expensive and tough decision for restaurant owners. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a restaurant owner yourself, have you been able to reopen fully or partially? Are you considering it? What kind of hit have you taken? If you're working at a restaurant or out of work at a restaurant, let us know how things are going for you. And restaurant customers, do you feel safe going in and eating at restaurants right now? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Dino is with us in Madison. Dino, hello.
Hey there. How are you doing?
Good. What's your story, Dino?
Well, I opened a small wine bar and Italian tapas restaurant on March 3rd. And we had about 12 days of phenomenal business, lines out the door, waiting room for tables and reservations, and then abruptly closed on the 13th. So I took about a week to catch my breath, and we came up with a to-go menu and a curbside takeout menu, which has been good. When the 25% opportunity arose, it didn't make sense for us with the number of people we could fit in the restaurant. It was less than 15. So this week, when we were allowed to move to phase two, we started to scratch our heads and figure out what to do. So we're going to try to reopen with outdoor patio and a prefix menu four nights a week and hope that that brings some folks back and we can start up again.
All right, Dino, thanks for calling and sharing your story. Good luck to you as you figure this out. Dino, not alone, Heather, trying to figure out how to make money on limited capacity.
Yeah, the capacity caps have really been a hard thing for restaurants to face. And I think, like Dino said, that some of these caps, you know, 25, even 50% can leave a restaurant with just a few customers that they can serve, especially for a smaller restaurant. I mean, you're really down to very small numbers that don't really make a lot of sense. Outdoor dining does seem to be helping, and a lot of cities, jurisdictions have made it easier for restaurants to apply for outdoor dining permits during this time. And that's been, I think, very helpful for some restaurants. But again, you know, those caps, I mean, it's just, especially, you know, a lot of restaurants make a lot of their business in a very small window of days, you know, Friday evening, Saturday, Sunday. And if you can't fill the capacity those days, you're really out for the rest of the week because Monday and Tuesday is often slow.
Dino, I'm so sorry about that timing. Good luck as you try to get rolling there again. Let's go to another caller at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Fort Atkinson. Scott, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just calling to say that I think it's safe for people to start visiting their restaurants again. I have been doing so, and I've noticed that all the restaurants I've been to have had so many implementations to make sure that me and all the other customers are safe. I mean, even replacing those sticky laminated menus with disposable ones. I mean, everything is disposable, and I don't know. People should go out and support their restaurants. I think it's safe to do so.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. And Heather, this is a big part of the story, customer perception of restaurant safety. Even as restaurants open, are people going to feel like Scott and want to go out to them?
Yeah, I think it really depends. One restaurant I was talking to says, you know, there's a certain percentage that were early returners, you know, just weren't afraid of the coronavirus and were just happy to come back. But, you know, there's a larger percentage that, you know, maybe somewhere in the middle. There's one subset that is just not going to go back to restaurants until there's a cure for the coronavirus. They just don't feel comfortable. And then there's a part in the middle where, you know, they could be persuaded if they see that a restaurant really is doing all the things, you know, like mentioned, you know, disposable menus, having someone cleaning all the time, making sure people are wearing masks, maybe having outdoor seating. So I think a lot of restaurants are really hoping that middle section, they can try to persuade to come back by spending on these implementations to show that they're committed to safety.
Thanks, Scott, for calling in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the obstacles facing restaurants as they try to reopen and swing back into gear. Heather Haddon is with us, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Let's bring on another caller now. Kevin is with us in Madison. Kevin, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I just want to share with the audience that we're one of the restaurants that did not open and will not reopen. And it was a simple calculus. First of all, we could have met the public safety and health-related concerns of our staff being able to comply with all the requirements, you know, post-COVID. The real issue became, and it's simple math, is that when we're asked to remove approximately 30% of our seats because of social distancing and the new rules, you know, the math would have driven up our prices to a point where we would not be competitive. And our business was located on State Street in Madison. And, you know, to stay competitive, we would have had to raise our prices to a price point that we believe could not be competitive. So we chose not to reopen.
And Kevin, not to reopen yet, or are you calling it quits for good on the restaurant?
This is a permanent closure.
I'm sorry to hear that, Kevin. Thank you, though, for sharing that story. Are a lot of people, Heather, in Kevin's boat and making that decision that they are done with the restaurant?
Yeah, so the National Restaurant Association, the main trade association for the restaurant industry, estimates that something like 3% of restaurants will not close, and by year's end, tens of thousands of restaurants will shutter, which obviously is very sad. People love their local restaurants. And, you know, we've already seen some bankruptcies also for some chains. You know, some of those might come out of bankruptcy, reemerge, but they'll probably close some locations. So no matter what, this is really starting to happen. And, you know, the restaurant industry is a big employer in the United States, and I think it is going to really impact a lot of people personally.
Thanks a lot for that call. And I got to think for that small restaurant owner, Heather, part of this is a labor of love. I don't think you open a single small restaurant thinking you're going to get rich doing this. This is sad for the people involved. This is something they put a lot of heart and soul into.
Absolutely. And you have to think, you know, when a restaurant closes, there's a lot of ripple effects. So, you know, all those suppliers that restaurant bought for, now that's, you know, they've lost a customer. Obviously, the workers in the restaurant have lost jobs, and there's another, you know, vacant storefront. And, you know, it really is a labor of love for a lot of these owners. So it is quite sad to see.
We heard from Nancy in Toma. She couldn't stay on the line. She says she's a server and she has a request. She asks that people accept the table that they're given. She says she gets people who say they want a different one, but the staff goes through a lot of trouble to make sure tables are clean, the space is prepared. And I imagine that's more important, you know, as they try to make sure people are sitting well apart from each other. Are there things that you think restaurant consumers can do to maybe cut those restaurant owners and staffers a little slack right now, Heather?
That's really interesting. Yeah. And it also just speaks to all the little changes that a customer might not even immediately notice that the restaurant is doing to try to accommodate them. So customers will notice that a syrup bottle that maybe a pancake house would have that you can refill is just not going to be on the table anymore. There's going to be packets, like a coffee urn to refill your coffee is not going to be there. And so a server is going to have to go back and forth every time someone wants syrup packets or a refill of coffee. So maybe being considerate of that for your server, maybe asking them to get some of those things when they initially come to the table and you order and not come back and forth a million times would be helpful.
Got a caller online. We won't have time for them, but they're warning as a restaurant owner, customers should maybe be ready for higher prices as places start to reopen to cover, you know, the limited capacity, the limited cost. Is that something we're seeing yet, Heather?
I think that's something we could see. I think a lot of owners are trying to be cognizant that they don't want to start raising prices just as people are coming back. And, you know, people have gotten stimulus checks, but are probably feeling a little penny pinch right now. So I think there is some caution about raising prices initially, but eventually they might very well have to be paying for all these expenses with less revenue. So could be something for down the road.
That question for our caller, Karen in Pewaukee. Thanks for letting me steal your question there, Karen. What are you watching for, Heather, as the restaurant industry tries to dig out just in our last minute?
Yeah, again, I think closures will be something to watch. You know, how many restaurants do decide that ultimately this isn't worth it? I do think there's going to be some chains that actually get stronger out of this. So some big franchises that have less competition now for maybe some smaller chains or independent restaurants and have convinced customers that they are safe and that they have drive-throughs that work and that they should come to them instead, they actually might benefit from some of these changes. So also looking for that as well.
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Heather Haddon is the restaurant reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She joined us today to talk about the cash crunch restaurants are facing as they start to try to reopen their doors around the country. Coming up after the news, part of advertising is knowing what your audience wants and needs, but what happens when your entire audience is asked to stay in the comfort of their own homes? We'll talk about the rise of pandemic ads and why they all kind of start to look the same. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's Elections Commission voted yesterday to send absentee ballot applications to 2.7 million registered voters in the state. We'll get the details on that decision coming up. First, maybe this sounds a little familiar.
In these times of uncertainty.
During this time of great uncertainty.
During these uncertain times.
During these uncertain times.
In uncertain times.
In uncertain times.
Uncertain times.
We're all familiar with the Super Bowl ad, but what about the pandemic ad? It's begun to take on its own identity. Advertisers want to meet their consumers where they're at, and they made some very quick, calculated moves to send out messages of reassurance in the early months of the pandemic. But our next guest says it all started to sound kind of the same. Amanda Hess is a critic at large for the New York Times. She writes about internet and pop culture for the arts section and contributes regularly to the New York Times Magazine. She wrote the piece and put together a video, The Pandemic Ad Salutes You. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
When, Amanda, did you start to feel that sense that all these messages from companies were starting to blur together?
You know, it started really early for me. I think in late March, I started noticing that the ads have changed from, you know, the very sort of common ad we're used to that shows a hamburger and all of the pleasure that you can have consuming it, to these ads that had, you know, very somber piano music, shots of empty streets, and then images of families experiencing some kind of silver lining under quarantine, often that never showed the product at all.
Yeah, what do you think is behind that thinking? We've seen, you know, companies try to keep their brands out there in bad times, but not look like they were trying to sell anything before. How are they trying to navigate that?
You know, one of the strains of these ads is to focus instead of on the product, on the employees who are creating the product. So the employees have really become the stars of the ads themselves. You see them working in Amazon warehouses or delivering FedEx packages or, you know, walking down the aisles of a supermarket wearing a mask. And I think there are a few impulses behind that. One is, I think it seeks to reassure consumers that whatever they're buying is a safe product. So it's created by people who are taking precautions. But it's also capitalizing on this idea that has arisen during the pandemic that essential workers are heroes. And so if you buy something from Amazon, the argument of the ads go, you are not just getting something that could help distract you or tide you over during quarantine, but help support these people who are being put forth as, you know, heroically working under these pandemic conditions.
You, in that video I mentioned, you shared part of an interview you did with a grocery store worker. Share how she felt about that whole hero concept.
Yeah, so she had worked at Trader Joe's when the coronavirus hit, and she started to see this narrative arise very quickly, both from her bosses and from consumers, and just from the corporate messaging that we're talking about, that people in her position who are grocery store clerks are heroes. And what she told me was that she really appreciated this idea that people were thanking her for doing her job. But she also felt like this hero framing tended to paper over the idea that her job all of a sudden was very dangerous. And especially at the beginning, people had no idea what the actual risks were to people in her position. But we do know that a lot of the people who are contracting the coronavirus are these essential workers. And so there's, to her, you know, she wants to emphasize that even though it comes from this, you know, nice, sort of good, well-meaning place to consider her a hero, that she is also a victim. And of course, the ads do not emphasize that element of the story.
Now, the essential workers portrayed as heroes in these ads. You noticed another theme, though. I want to hear another group of heroes here in a Burger King ad.
Your country needs you to stay on your couch and order in. Do your part, and we'll do ours. Order through the Burger King app, and the delivery fees are on us. So staying home doesn't just make us all safer. It makes you a couch patriot.
So we are the heroes if we stay home and buy your product.
Yeah, so Burger King is obviously having a little bit of fun with that idea, but it's also a real strain of these ads where I think first what we saw was places like Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's emphasized that they were feeding frontline workers. So they were feeding nurses. You saw a ton of nurses, people in all sorts of PPE in their ads. And then there was this kind of extension of that idea. So not just that a place like McDonald's might serve a hero, but that really anyone who went to McDonald's and contributed to the economy could also kind of consider themselves a hero. And Burger King is both kind of making fun of that idea and also exploiting it to get people to order from the restaurant.
Talking to Amanda Hess, critic at large for the New York Times, about a piece she wrote and a video she made looking at pandemic ads and why they all start to look and sound the same. Let's check out the soundscape of one of these ads. This one, I think, is Uber. A lot of them don't have the talking. They just have images, the music, and maybe some words on a screen. Here's a little bit of the sound of one of these ads. Hey, it was kind of sad, but now it's kind of happy, Amanda.
Yeah, I think the written message of the Uber ad ended up being thank you for not riding Uber, which is obviously a total reversal from what an ad is typically for. But yeah, there tends to be an emotional shift in these ads. So first, there's like a somber acknowledgement that we're living in unprecedented times. But then there's this upbeat sort of key change that, you know, the human spirit is rising above it. And of course, the brand then aligns itself with this optimistic message at the end of the video.
And Amanda, I'm going to make a confession here. Obviously, a lot of these ads are, you know, they're trying to get an emotional response. And on me, they work. Even just watching the clips of them in your piece where you're talking about how, you know, this is a strategy and how they work. Yeah, there are moments where I even feel a little choked up watching these things. You too? Or is this just me?
Yeah, no, they've absolutely gotten me. I mean, one thing that a lot of the ads emphasize is there are a lot of pregnant women in the ads. So there are pregnant women, you know, staring out the window, touching their stomachs, and sort of like representing this optimistic future. And for me, as someone who's like 7 months pregnant right now, I think they can get me a little bit before I start to think about, you know, exactly what the image is working for. And then it does come from, you know, a multinational company.
Another theme you note in this is that a lot of these ads are using, you know, actual people type stuff, or at least things that look like that, things that, you know, people might have made at home and then posted on their own on social media. What kinds of stuff?
Yeah, so you see these videos that appear to be taken by cell phones. And so some of them show like a baby riding on a Roomba, or a dog that's walking on like an exercise ball, or any other sort of like amusing quarantine scene that you might have captured when you're bored in your house. There's also some drone footage that's been used. There is a Dunkin' Donuts ad of a grandfather who had delivered some donut holes to his grandchildren with a drone. And those just kind of like implicate us in this whole idea. And they imply that, you know, these little videos that we're making, these little experiences that we're having are constructive. And so we too are contributing to this kind of like resistance against the pandemic.
Now, I'm sure marketing companies are going to spend lots of money to try to answer this question. But what do you think, Amanda, as you watch these, about, you know, the impact they might have on people and how we perceive the brands making these pandemic ads?
You know, it's interesting because in a lot of cases, I'm someone who doesn't watch the news on television very often. And so I was really seeing images of the pandemic exclusively through the ads. When I started to see them, it was really the only place that I was being kind of directly confronted with a lot of the imagery from it. You know, I'm in New York, and so for a time, this was the epicenter of it, but you really don't see much when you're sitting in your house. And so I think what these companies are trying to do with that is A, not seem like they're being insensitive in this time that's so horrible for so many people. So not just running a standard ad, but also, you know, trying to position themselves, I think, for the future, for when things return to normal, that there's some kind of sense that we were all in it together, us and the brands, and maybe that will make us feel better about the product when we have hopefully a little bit more spending money.
And as we wrap up, Amanda, we're mostly not stuck at home anymore, at least not legally. But now we have the death of George Floyd and the protests that followed on that. Are you watching to see how companies are getting that, you know, trying to advertise and not look insensitive during the protests?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen any classic TV ads yet that respond to that, but there are so many PR and brand messages on social media. And it's really sort of, it's surprising, you know, I've never seen so many companies react in such a way where even the NFL is releasing a video saying that it all of a sudden it supports its players peacefully protesting. And I think that, you know, part of it is that it's happening during the pandemic and there's so much pressure on the internet and everything that we're experiencing on the internet. And so when something huge like that happens, I think it takes over every segment of our culture. And also it's just the impact of social media on advertising, I think, where now if you're putting an ad out on Twitter or Facebook, the way for it to be seen or the way for your statement to be seen is for it to in some way reference current events, reference the things that people are talking about on social media. And so, yeah, it will be interesting to see how companies continue to navigate that.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Amanda Hess, critic at large at the New York Times. She writes about internet and pop culture for the arts section and contributes to the New York Times Magazine. She wrote the piece, "The Pandemic Ad Salutes You," and made a video to accompany that. Coming up, the state's election commission will be sending absentee ballot request forms to all registered voters, many of them at least ahead of the November election. We'll get the details coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, so you want to go on vacation, but you're worried about social distancing. One solution some people are turning to, get an RV. We'll look at the growing popularity during the pandemic and get some tips on how to make the most of RV summer road trip. First, after Wisconsin's April primary election got national attention for being held during the height of concern over the COVID-19 pandemic, state officials have been debating the best way to prepare for the November election. A record number of Wisconsinites voted by mail in April, and a new high mark is expected in the fall. The latest development came yesterday when the state's Bipartisan Elections Commission voted unanimously to send absentee ballot applications to Wisconsin's registered voters. The commission voted in favor of the mailing late last month. Yesterday's decision locks it down. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, we've talked about this before, Sean. Who will and who won't get a ballot request as a result of this decision?
I would say for the most part, if you are a registered voter and you have not already requested an absentee ballot be sent to you for the remaining elections in 2020, then you're going to get one of these pieces of mail that tells you all about how you can get an absentee ballot and includes a form where you can request one through the mail if you want. There's also another smaller group of people, about 158,000 people, whose names were flagged by a multi-state government database as having potentially moved. These mailers will not be sent to those addresses, but everyone else is going to get one. So you're looking at 2.7 million registered voters in Wisconsin.
And an important point, just to hammer home what you said and not blur things here, these are ballot applications, not ballots, right?
Yeah. Very, very important point to drive home there, that this is not a ballot that's going to get sent in the mail to all of these people. They are request forms, applications. They give people the option to send the form back and get a ballot sent to them by mail for the November election specifically. But this is not the ballot itself. And in fact, the vast majority of people who receive these mailers are not expected to send them back.
Why is that? Just there might be people who plan to vote in person no matter what?
I think it's just a kind of the nature of a mail campaign. The staff at the Elections Commission is expecting like 1% of people who get these pieces of mail will actually take the time to mail back these forms and get their ballot that way. A lot of people who are going to get their absentee ballot forms are going to do it through the way they did it in April. They go to myvote.wi.gov and sign up electronically to get their ballots that way.
If I am going to get this thing in the mail, when am I going to get it?
Around September 1st, and that's supposed to be the way that it works for everybody. Normally, when the state has a mailing like this, they would kind of send it out as they get it printed because it's a massive mailing. The State Elections Commission said you're looking at like 3 semi-truck trailers full if you stacked up all these ballots together. But in an effort to try to have this thing distributed fairly and around the same time, what the state's going to do is they're going to print all these ballots, store them up, and then send them out around September 1st. And then people will have until late October to get them back to the state.
Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the state's plan to send 2.7 million or so absentee ballot applications to many registered voters in the state. Now, the significance of this decision yesterday, Sean, we talked in the past when this Elections Commission made the decision, yeah, we're going to do this, but there was that one open-ended thing there where they all had to agree on the language. It sounded like back a month ago that might have been a stumbling block. Was it ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, anything that the Elections Commission does on a unanimous vote that has any kind of a partisan inkling is pretty significant because it is split 3-3 between Republicans and Democrats. And on a lot of the more contentious questions, you get 3-3 votes, meaning nothing happens. So there was always that possibility that that could happen with this proposal, which was produced by staff at the commission, but you've seen absentee balloting become more partisan elsewhere. I mean, President Trump has spoken out against it pretty extensively. He threatened to withhold federal funding to Michigan when Michigan sent out absentee ballot request forms to its voters. You did not see that really play out in that same way in Wisconsin, though. Republican members of the commission, a couple of them in particular, have issues with promoting absentee balloting. But you've also heard Republicans here say that, look, if Democrats are going to do it, Republicans need to do it too. They're okay if people are going to get these mailings in, say, Madison and Milwaukee because of local mailings that are similar to what the state's doing. Republicans are on board with sending it to other parts of the state.
There was a last-ditch effort. One Republican lawmaker, Rick Gundrum of Slinger, wanted the commission to drop the plan. What case did he make?
The case that he made was that clerks in his district didn't ask for it, that they were concerned about the workload that they're going to have in the upcoming election as is. I think it's you have to note, though, that the way that this plan is structured, the forms are going to be handled by state workers, or at least temporary workers under the guidance of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, that they're going to handle the mailing, that the mailings will come back to the state. It'll still be up to local clerks to verify that voters are who they say they are through the state's photo ID law, because you still have to produce a copy of a photo ID in order to vote by mail. But a lot of the rest of the process will be handed by somebody other than clerks. And clerks also are going to get millions of dollars spread throughout the state through a separate federal grant pool.
Let's talk about the motivation for this, Sean, going back to the April elections when a lot of people suddenly decided, hey, I'd rather vote by mail than going to polls in the midst of this pandemic. Is this all an effort to try to avoid that last minute bottleneck that we saw in a lot of ways?
Yeah, it's exactly that, because when you're looking at the November election, we don't know what turnout's going to be, but history tells us it'll be about double what we had in the April election. You know, instead of 1.5 million people voting, you're going to have closer to 3 million people voting in a presidential election, which always draws more interest. And so if you're going to have that many people voting, and if the COVID-19 pandemic is still going on, which, to the best of our knowledge, it will be, people are still going to be taking advantage of voting absentee. And so you could have just a huge surge in the November election of absentee balloting. So this is really an effort to kind of get ahead of that. And, not only does the mailing give people a form to send back if they want to, it just informs them that it's an option. I think the state's trying to get people to think about this a little bit before the deadline, because in the last election, the April election, you just had this, this real influx of late absentee ballots that came in that kind of overwhelmed clerks a bit, or at least stressed them, seemed to stress the postal system. Some of them didn't get delivered. And without a federal court ruling that delayed when these ballots could be returned, you would have had 79,000 ballots that did not get counted. So you had a bunch coming in at the last minute last time. If this is going to be a close election watched nationally with national significance, I think, it's in everybody's best interest to not have all those ballots coming in at the very last minute.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson talking about the State Elections Commission. Find more at wisconsinvote.org. We talked yesterday on the show about big league sports and their plans to get back into action. But since there isn't much to watch yet, unless you're an international soccer fan, it's time for a long overdue installment of the competitive event we've been watching here on Central Time, the state-by-state census competition. The census return rate follows the proportion of people in each state who have returned their census questionnaires or done them online without additional pestering needed. As you may remember, Wisconsin was in first place at one point. We've been neck and neck with our neighbors in Minnesota. As of this afternoon, we are in second place. Minnesota leads the nation at 71.1% returned. Wisconsin close behind at 68.5%. Michigan and Iowa tied for third at 67.8%. Nebraska just behind them. All those numbers compared to the national average of just 61.5%. By the way, at the county level, Wisconsin holds four of the top five slots. Ozaukee, Washington, Waukesha, and Calumet counties are at 1, 2, 3, and 5, respectively. As a state, we can still pull ahead of Minnesota. It's late in the game. It's the ninth inning. Fourth and goal. It's the 18th hole, and we can still pull off a buzzer beater in extra time. Sorry, with no sports, I'm really out of practice with my metaphors. It's sports-ish news you can use. This is Central Time.